Chapter 9. From that sinister condition which made Caesar anxious every year, to get clear of its glooms before the autumnal equinox, a kind of landscape and weather which leads travelers from the south, to describe our island as Homer's Cimmerian land, was not, on the face of it, friendly to women. It might reasonably have been supposed that she was listening to the wind, which rose somewhat as the night advanced, and laid hold of the attention. The wind, indeed, seemed made for the scene, as the scene seemed made for the hour. Part of its tone was quite special. What was heard there could be heard nowhere else. Gusts in innumerable series followed each other from the northwest, and when each one of them raced past, the sound of its progress resolved into three. Treble, tenor, and bass notes were to be found there. The general ricochet of the whole over pits and prominences at the gravest pitch of the chime. Next there could be heard the baritone buzz of a holly tree. Below these in force, above them in pitch, a dwindled voice strove hard at a husky tune, which was the peculiar local sound alluded to. Thinner and less immediately traceable than the other two, it was far more impressive than either. In it lay what may be called the linguistic peculiarity of the heath, and being audible nowhere on earth off a heath, it afforded a shadow of reason for the woman's tenseness, which continued as unbroken as ever. Throughout the blowing of these plaintive November winds, that note bore a great resemblance to the ruins of human song which remained to the throat of 80. It was a worn whisper, dry and papery, and it brushed so distinctly across the ear that, by the accustomed, the material minutiae in which it originated could be realized as by touch. It was the united products of infinitesimal vegetable causes, and these were neither stems, leaves, fruit, blades, prickles, lichen, nor moss. They were the mummied heath bells of the past summer, originally tender and purple, now washed colorless by Michaelmas rains, and dried to dead skins by October suns. So low was an individual sound from these, that a combination of hundreds only just emerged from silence, and the myriads of the whole declivity reached the woman's ear, but as a shriveled and intermittent recitative. Yet scarcely a single accent among the many afloat tonight could have such power to impress a listener with thoughts of its origin. One inwardly saw the infinity of those combined multitudes, and perceived that each of the tiny trumpets was seized on, entered, scoured and emerged from by the wind as thoroughly as if it were as vast as a crater. The spirit moved them. A meaning of the phrase forced itself upon the attention, and an emotional listener's fetishistic mood might have ended in one of more advanced quality. It was not, after all, that the left-hand expanse of old blooms spoke, or the right hand, or those of the slope in front, but it was the single person of something else speaking through each at once. Suddenly, on the barrow, there mingled with all this wild rhetoric of night a sound which modulated so naturally into the rest, that its beginning and ending were hardly to be distinguished. The bluffs, and the bushes, and the heather bells had broken silence. At last, so did the woman, and her articulation was but as another phrase of the same discourse as theirs. Thrown out on the winds it became twined in with them, and with them it flew away. What she uttered was a lengthened sighing, apparently at something in her mind which had led to her presence here. There was a spasmodic abandonment about it, as if, in allowing herself to utter the sound, the woman's brain had authorized what it could not regulate. One point was evident in this, that as he had been existing in a suppressed state, and not in one of languor or stagnation. Far away down the valley the faint shine from the window of the inn still lasted on, and a few additional moments proved that the window, or what was within it, had more to do with the woman's sigh than had either her own actions or the scene immediately around. She lifted her left hand, which held a closed telescope. This she rapidly extended, as if she were well accustomed to the operation, and raising it to her eye directed it towards the light beaming from the inn. The handkerchief which had hooded her head was now a little thrown back, her face being somewhat elevated. A profile was visible against the dull monochrome of cloud around her, and it was as though side shadows from the features of Sappho and Mrs. Siddons had converged upwards from the tomb, to form an image like neither but suggesting both. This, however, was mere superficiality. In respect of character, a face may make certain admissions by its outline, but it fully confesses only in its changes. So much is this the case, that what is called the play of the features often helps more in understanding a man or woman than the earnest labors of all the other members together. Thus the knight revealed little of her whose form it was embracing, for the mobile parts of her countenance could not be seen. At last she gave up her spying attitude, closed the telescope, and turned to the decaying embers. From these no appreciable beams now radiated, except when a more than usually smart gust brushed over their faces, and raised a fitful glow which came and went like the blush of a girl. She stooped over the silent circle, and selecting from the brands a piece of stick which bore the largest live coal at its end, brought it to where as he had been standing before. She held the brand to the ground, blowing the red coal with her mouth at the same time, till it faintly illuminated the sod, and revealed a small object, which turned out to be an herglis, though she wore a watch. She blew long enough to show that the sand had all slipped through. "Ah," she said, as if surprised. The light raised by her breath had been very fitful, and a momentary irradiation of flesh was all that it had disclosed of her face. That consisted of two matchless lips and a cheek only, her head being still enveloped. She threw away the stick, took the glass in her hand, the telescope under her arm, and moved on. Along the ridge ran a faint foot track, which the lady followed. Those who knew it well called it a path, and, while a mere visitor would have passed it unnoticed even by day, the regular haunters of the heath were at no loss for it at midnight. The whole secret of following these incipient paths, when there was not light enough in the atmosphere to show a turnpike road, lay in the development of the sense of touch in the feet, which comes with years of night rambling in little trodden spots. To a walker practiced in such places, a difference between impact on maiden herbage and on the crippled stalks of a slight footway is perceptible through the thickest boot or shoe. The solitary figure who walked this beat took no notice of the windy tune still played on the dead heath bells. She did not turn her head to look at a group of dark creatures further on, who fled from her presence as she skirted a ravine, where they fed. They were about a score of the small wild ponies known as heath croppers. They roamed at large on the undulations of Egdon, but in numbers too few to detract much from the solitude. The pedestrian noticed nothing just now, and a clue to her abstraction was afforded by a trivial incident. A bramble caught hold of her skirt and checked her progress. Instead of putting it off and hastening along, she yielded herself up to the pull and stood passively still. When she began to extricate herself, it was by turning round and round, and so unwinding the prickly switch. She was in a desponding reverie. Her course was in the direction of the small undying fire which had drawn the attention of the men on Rainbarrow, and of Wildove in the valley below. A faint illumination from its rays began to glow upon her face, and the fire soon revealed itself to be lit, not on the level ground, but on a salient corner or redan of earth, at the junction of two converging bank fences. Outside was a ditch, dry except immediately under the fire, where there was a large pool, bearded all round by heather and rushes. In the smooth water of the pool the fire appeared upside down. The banks meeting behind were bare of a hedge, save such as was formed by disconnected tufts of firs, standing upon stems along the top, like impaled heads above a city wall. A white mast, fitted up with spars and other nautical tackle, could be seen rising against the dark clouds, whenever the flames played brightly enough to reach it. Altogether the scene had much the appearance of a fortification upon which had been kindled a beacon fire. Nobody was visible, but ever and anon a whitish something moved above the bank from behind, and vanished again. This was a small human hand, in the act of lifting pieces of fuel into the fire, but for all that could be seen the hand, like that which troubled Belshazzar, was there alone. Occasionally an ember rolled off the bank, and dropped with a hiss into the pool. At one side of the pool rough steps built of clods enabled everyone who wished to do so to mount the bank, which the woman did. Within was a paddock in an uncultivated state, though bearing evidence of having once been tilled, but the heath and fern had insidiously crept in, and were reasserting their old supremacy. Further ahead were dimly visible an irregular dwelling house, garden, and outbuildings, backed by a clump of firs. The young lady for youth had revealed its presence in her buoyant bound up the bank walked along the top instead of descending inside, and came to the corner, where the fire was burning. One reason for the permanence of the blaze was now manifest. The fuel consisted of hard pieces of wood, cleft and sawn the knotty boles of old thorn trees which grew in twos and threes about the hillsides. A yet unconsumed pile of these lay in the inner angle of the bank. And from this corner the upturned face of a little boy greeted Reeves. He was dilatorily throwing up a piece of wood into the fire every now and then, a business which seemed to have engaged him a considerable part of the evening, for his face was somewhat weary. "I am glad you have come, Miss Eustacia," he said, with a sigh of relief. "Don't like biting by myself." "Nonsense. I have only been a little way for a walk. I have been gone only 20 minutes. "It seemed long," murmured the sad boy. "And you have been so many times. Why, I thought you would be pleased to have a bonfire. Are you not much obliged to me for making you one?" "Yes, but there's nobody here to play why me." "I suppose nobody has come while I've been away? Nobody except your grandfather. He looked out of doors once for ye. I told him you were walking round upon the hill, to look at the other bonfires." "A good boy. I think I hear him coming again, miss." An old man came into the remoter light of the fire from the direction of the homestead. He was the same who had overtaken the Redelman on the road that afternoon. He looked wistfully to the top of the bank at the woman who stood there, and his teeth, which were quite unimpaired, showed like parian from his parted lips. "When are you coming indoors, Eustacia?" he asked. "'Tis almost bedtime. I've been home these 2 hours, and am tired out. Surely 'tis somewhat childish of you to stay out playing at bonfire so long, and wasting such fuel. My precious thorn roots, the rarest of all firing, that I laid by on purpose for Christmas, you have burned them nearly all. I promised Johnny a bonfire, and it pleases him not to let it go out just yet," said Eustacia, in a way which told at once that she was absolute queen here. "Grandfather, you go into bed. I shall follow you soon. You like the fire, don't you, Johnny?" The boy looked up doubtfully at her and murmured, "I don't think I want it any longer." Her grandfather had turned back again, and did not hear the boy's reply. As soon as the white-haired man had vanished, she said in a tone of pique to the child, "Ungrateful little boy, how can you contradict me? Never shall you have a bonfire again, unless you keep it up now. Come, tell me you like to do things for me, and don't deny it." The repressed child said, "Yes, I do, miss," and continued to stir the fire perfunctorily. "Stay a little longer, and I will give you a crooked sixpence," said Eustacia, more gently. "Put in one piece of wood every 2 or 3 minutes, but not too much at once. I am going to walk along the ridge a little longer, but I shall keep on coming to you. And if you hear a frog jump into the pond with a flounce like a stone thrown in, be sure you run and tell me, because it is a sign of rain." "Yes, Eustacia." "Miss Vi, sir." "Miss Vi Stacia." "That will do. Now put in one stick more." The little slave went on feeding the fire as before. He seemed a mere automaton, galvanized into moving and speaking by the wayward Eustacia's will. He might have been the brass statue which Albertus Magnus is said to have animated, just so far as to make it chatter and move and be his servant. Before going on her walk again, the young girl stood still on the bank for a few instants and listened. It was to the full as lonely a place as Rainbarrow, though at rather a lower level, and it was more sheltered from wind and weather on account of the few firs to the north. The bank which enclosed the homestead, and protected it from the lawless state of the world without, was formed of thick square clods, dug from the ditch on the outside, and built up with a slight batterer incline, which forms no slight defense, where hedges will not grow, because of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.